Hello.
Hi, is that Neil Howe?
Speaking.
Hey, Neil, it's Guy Raz with the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for calling.
Anyway, I'm calling because we can't figure out how to do our show today without using the M word.
I see.
And I'm a little worried right now because people listening, they will, they'll hear it, they'll just turn the radio off.
Is that right?
And you are the guy that coined it. You're responsible for this, right?
I apologize for that. Yes, many many years ago, and it's been through a few phases.
So this is Neil Howe. He's a demographer, and back in 1991, he co-wrote a book with William Strauss. It was called Generations, and tucked into the middle of that book a chapter. Its title, The Millennial Generation. Lots of people hear this and they're thinking lazy, spoiled, entitled.
Well, you need a little memory here. Gen X used to be practically a swear word. It was a non-label label. It was like some huge tragedy. You just didn't want to talk about it. We used to complain that kids were under-socialized. They were practically going feral. Well, here's what's amazing. If you talk to young people today in college, they will talk about how they want to someday be good neighbors, good citizens. Record shares say they someday want to get married and have kids. And if you ask them their favorite way to spend their time, they say with their parents, with their family. I hear people talk about them. They're too fragile. They're accustomed to too much cosseting and protection. Here's an interesting question I would have for you. Was there ever a time when older people said, I think it's just right?
On the show today, TED speakers, most of them millennials, people born between 1981 and 2000, close to a third of all Americans now. And in big ways and small ones, they're changing our world really fast. And there is a possibility, a big one, that after listening to this episode, you might come to this conclusion. They could be the greatest generation.
They could. We will see. But it's who they are, how they were raised, and it's where they want to take this country. I think that's what makes them so exciting and different.
Hey, Neil, thanks.
Thank you, and good luck with your show.
All right, sir.
Okay, bye.
Bye. So as Neil just explained, there are a lot of things that make millennials different from the two previous generations. And one of the things he found in his research is that a lot of millennials want to have a meaningful impact on the world around them. And the other thing? They actually like their parents, which is where Natalie Warren's story begins, as told on the TED stage.
My mom is a strong Black woman who raised her kids to have the same sense of strength and pride. The spirit was epitomized by a single wall in our small two-bedroom apartment on the south side of Chicago. Two pictures hung proudly, one larger-than-life photo of my siblings and I, and the other, a picture of my mom at 12 years old, staring into the eyes of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. When I was younger, I used to stand on my tippy toes, stare at that picture, close my eyes tightly, and just pretend that it was me. Now, obviously, I didn't meet Dr. King, but I met a man named Dr. Vincent Harding. He worked with Dr. King from day one and even wrote some of his most iconic speeches. You see, this was a really important moment for me as a kid because it was the first time that I realized that it wasn't just Dr. King who led this revolution, but he was surrounded by a movement made up of people who are motivated by conviction and not recognition.
Natalie didn't actually realize how significant that moment would be in her life until she was 17. Her senior year of high school, when she was feeling
really antsy and I wasn't really staying in class, and 2 weeks before school ended, there was an assembly.
It was optional, but Natalie went anyway.
Not because I thought I was going to learn anything, just because I wanted to get out of class. And we sat there, and there was three young people that got on stage. They couldn't have been more than 23. And they just introduced, and they said, for the last 20 years, there's been a war in Central East Africa.
And at that assembly, they showed this documentary.
Well, after having seen the suffering of the civilian population in northern Uganda, I'm appalled, frankly. It's a moral outrage.
It was about children in Uganda who were being kidnapped by a warlord named Joseph Kony and then forced to fight in his rebel army, some of those kids as young as 9 years old.
They are seeking out children who are going to be the most moldable and the most easy to brainwash, essentially, into being a soldier.
It just completely rocked and, like, deconstructed my world, because you're like, well, God, this is a million miles away in a place I will probably never go, happening to people I will probably never meet, and, like, what can I do? So they instantly turned it around and gave us action steps.
They told Natalie she could raise money for the group or do simple things like spread the word online, or she could join them in San Diego at the group's headquarters. It's called Invisible Children.
So I raised money, and in 2 weeks or 3 weeks after that, my parents and I got in a car and drove to San Diego, and they dropped me off at the Invisible Children office, and the rest is history. And I worked there.
So if that name Invisible Children sounds familiar, it's probably because you were one of the 100 million people who watched their documentary called Kony 2012. It came out in March of that year. And it is, to this day, the fastest spreading viral video in history, not without controversy, which we'll get to in a moment. But Natalie's story happened 2 years before all of that, because at age 17, she found her thing. She found a purpose, a cause, as important to her as the civil rights movement was to her mother. And her first task...
We were going to plan an event called the Rescue of Joseph Kony's Child Soldiers, where participants would come in 100 cities worldwide and rally in their city center until a celebrity or a political figure came and used their voice on behalf of these child soldiers. And at that point, each city was rescued. But the catch was, we weren't leaving the cities until we were rescued. I was given Chicago and 9 other cities, and I told my bosses, I was like, if we're going for big name people, why not go for the Queen Bee? Why not go for Oprah Winfrey? They thought I was a little idealistic, but I mean, we were trying to think big. We were doing an impossible thing, so why not try to reach more impossible things?
And what it took? 1,152.
This is the number of hours that I spent on logistics, from getting permits to rallying participants and finding venues.
460.
This is the number of times that I was rejected by celebrities, agents, or politician secretaries.
$336.
That is the number of the amount of money that I spent personally on Red Bull and Diet Coke to stay awake during this movement. You can judge me if you want to. These were just some of the ridiculous things that we did to try and pull this event off. And so April 21st rolls around and the event begins. 100 cities around the world, they were beautiful. 6 days later, all the cities were rescued but one, Chicago. People started coming from all over the world, all over the country, to be reinforcements and join their voice with ours. And finally, on May 1st, we wrapped ourselves around Oprah's studio, and we got her attention.
First, when I drove into the office this morning, there was a giant, when you all came in, was there a group outside?
Yes.
Holding up signs asking if I would talk to them for just 5 minutes. And they are with a group called Invisible Children.
So the engine, the energy that powered Invisible Children, millennials, and it became one of the most powerful social movements in the past decade, founded and led mainly by teens and people in their 20s and early 30s.
I honestly think if I did it when I was 23, I don't think I would have had the exact confidence in saying we're going to get Oprah as I did when I was 18. Because I think at 18, everything was limitless and everything was possible, just because I hadn't been told otherwise yet. I just thought, if we work hard, something has to come from it.
But 2 years later, a very generational setback. A viral video.
A video about an African warlord goes viral around the world.
The 30-minute video was posted on YouTube Monday and quickly went viral.
The documentary has been viewed more than 74 million times on YouTube.
So as we mentioned, Invisible Children made a video called Kony 2012. It was a powerful documentary with the same message as the one Natalie saw in high school. And last March, it became the fastest spreading viral video in history. And that success also brought a lot of negative attention. Soon, critics were calling the group naive, and false accusations started to spread. Relentless personal attacks against the group's co-founder, Jason Russell, and he had a very public and embarrassing meltdown. And for thousands of volunteers like Natalie, who'd worked so hard to get publicity that was now turning into something so damaging, it was devastating.
I had a lot of family and friends who called me and came up to me that same day and just were really upset because they thought that I had been lying to them about what we were doing, and I would constantly say, like, I will tell you anything. I'll give you the stats. I'll tell you what's going on, where the money goes. I'll tell you anything, but we just have to have a conversation.
It's interesting because the flip side of all the optimism and all the energy and possibilities that the so-called millennial generation have, there's also the access to feedback and comments.
Yeah. I don't think I ever understood that to that extreme until the controversy of Kony 2012. You know, and it's still sometimes hard to kind of grasp how just dark it all got.
The flip side is a group of teenagers and 20-year-olds made sure that everyone in the world knew who Joseph Kony was.
Yeah. That is the flip side. It's crazy. And it worked.
Now, whatever you might think of Invisible Children, that part is undeniable. In January of this year, leaders from Invisible Children joined President Obama in the Oval Office, where he signed a tough bill that includes millions of dollars to help find Joseph Kony.
You know, the Oprah moments, they prove that the supposedly impossible can be done. They inspire us, they boost our confidence, but the moment isn't a movement. You know, for me, what kept me pushing on through the rescue was the thought of those child soldiers. It became personal to me. But that doesn't have to be what drives you. Whatever you want, chase after it with everything that you have, not because of the fame or the fortune, but solely because that's what you believe in, because that's what makes your heart sing. Despite what people think, my Oprah moments, my being on TED, doesn't define me. Because if you were to follow me home to LA, you would see me waiting tables and nannying to pay the bills as I chase after my dream of becoming a filmmaker. That's what is going to define our generation, when we start chasing and fighting after the things that we love and that we want to fight for. And believe me, when the door is closed and the cameras are off, it's tough. But if there's one thing that I want to drive home to you, one thing that I can say, not just to you, but to myself, is that is the acts that make us extraordinary, not the Oprah moments. Thank you.
That's Natalie Warren. She's 23 now, living in LA and working on a whole bunch of social change campaigns. Check out her full talk at TED.com. More millennials in a moment. I'm Guy Raz. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. Our show today is about 13 to 33-year-olds, millennials, sometimes called selfish or infantile or lazy, but what if they're actually on the cusp of being the next greatest generation? A generation defined by huge, world-changing events, 9/11, the Arab Spring, the election of Obama, and the economic collapse, something that's forced them to be more resourceful and nimble and creative. And they may have to start getting it together a lot faster. Which brings us to Meg Jay, who is not a millennial. She's a psychologist.
And I specialize in 20-somethings.
So that's like a very specialized specialization.
Yes, it is.
But nobody really cares a whole lot about 20-somethings because they're just like bums and they're lazy and they're just leeches and parasites and they just live off the fat of their parents.
Well, and that's the problem. That's what we're hearing, and it's just not true. It's an incredibly important time developmentally.
Okay, so if you're in your 20s, you might want to listen really closely to your radio right now because according to Meg Jay, your 20s, those years are your defining decade, the turning point in discovering a lot of things about yourself. Here's how she starts her TED Talk.
When I was in my 20s, I saw my very first psychotherapy client. I was a PhD student in clinical psychology at Berkeley. She was a 26-year-old woman named Alex. Now, Alex walked into her first session wearing jeans and a big slouchy top, and she dropped onto the couch in my office and kicked off her flats and told me she was there to talk about guy problems. Now, when I heard this, I was so relieved. My classmate got an arsonist for her first client, and I got a 20-something who wanted to talk about boys. This, I thought I could handle. But I didn't handle it. With the funny stories that Alex would bring to session, it was easy for me just to nod my head while we kicked the can down the road. 30's the new 20, Alex would say, and as far as I could tell, she was right. Work happened later, marriage happened later, kids happened later, even death happened later. 20-somethings like Alex and I had nothing but time. But before long, my supervisor pushed me to push Alex about her love life. I pushed back. I said, sure, she's dating down. She's sleeping with a knucklehead. But it's not like she's going to marry the guy. And then my supervisor said, not yet, but she might marry the next one. Besides, the best time to work on Alex's marriage is before she has one. That was the moment I realized 30's not the new 20. Yes, people settle down later than they used to, but that didn't make Alex's 20s a developmental downtime. That made Alex's 20s a developmental sweet spot, and we were sitting there blowing it.
How long have we known that this period is actually really significant?
You know, I would say it's been within the last 10, 15 years, and part of what my work is about is helping 20-somethings understand this is really the critical period of adult development, much in the same way that the first 5 years are the critical period of childhood development.
We know that 80% of life's most defining moments take place by age 35.
That's when more than half of Americans will marry their partner or find their partner.
We know that the first 10 years of a career has an exponential impact on how much money you're going to earn. We know that the brain caps off its second and last growth spurt in your 20s as it rewires itself for adulthood, which means that whatever it is you want to change about yourself, now is the time to change it.
So in your 20s, that happens? Your brain is actually rewiring?
Yes, it's rewiring itself for the demands of adult life.
So this is all happening in your frontal lobe.
That's the part that gets beyond black and white thinking and is able to tolerate gray areas.
The part of the brain that can imagine the future.
That balances emotion with reason.
And then in your late teens,
the brain is basically saying, I'm here to learn about adulthood. Show me what I need to know. We sprout thousands and thousands of new neurons, and neurons that fire together wire together. And that process goes on from the teens through the 20s. If you can take that changing brain and put it in an enriching environment, so allow that 20-something to invest in adult roles in the workplace or in adult-like relationships, it feeds back into the brain.
Leonard Bernstein said that to achieve great things, you need a plan and not quite enough time. Isn't that true? So what do you think happens when you pat a 20-something on the head and you say you have 10 extra years to start your life? Nothing happens. You have robbed that person of his urgency and ambition, and absolutely nothing happens. When a lot has been pushed to your 30s, there is enormous 30-something pressure to jumpstart a career, pick a city, partner up, and have two or three kids in a much shorter period of time.
Okay, so you're hearing this and you're thinking, what do I do? Well, here's the story of a patient Meg worked with who she calls Emma. How'd you first meet her?
How did I meet her? Well, she came into my office and she said she was having an identity crisis.
She said she thought she might like to work in art or entertainment, but she hadn't decided yet, so she'd spent the last few years waiting tables instead.
She was living with a boyfriend, not someone who she was particularly attached to or in love with, but because it was cheaper. And she told me that this young man was more interested in showing his temper
more than his ambition. And as hard as her 20s were, her early life had been even harder. She often cried in our sessions, but then would collect herself by saying, you can't pick your family, but you can pick your friends.
She came in one day, and she hung her head in her lap, and she just
sobbed. She'd just bought a new address book, and she'd spent the morning filling in her many contacts. But then she'd been left staring at that empty blank that comes after the words, in case of emergency, please call. Now, in that moment, it took everything I had not to say, I will. But what Emma needed wasn't some therapist who really, really cared. Emma needed a better life, and I knew this was her chance. First, I told Emma to forget about having an identity crisis and get some identity capital. Do something that adds value to who you are. So now is the time for that cross-country job, that internship, that startup you want to try. I'm not discounting 20-something exploration here, but I am discounting exploration that's not supposed to count. Second, 20-somethings who huddle together with like-minded peers limit who they know, what they know, how they think, how they speak, and where they work. That new piece of capital, that new person to date, almost always comes from outside the inner circle. New things come from what are called our weak ties, our friends of friends of friends. Last but not least, Emma believed that you can't pick your family, but you can pick your friends. I told Emma the time to start picking your family is now. The best time to work on your marriage is before you have one, and that means being as intentional with love as you are with work. So what happened to Emma? Well, we went through that address book, and she found an old roommate's cousin who worked at an art museum in another state. That weak tie helped her get a job there. That job offer gave her the reason to leave that live-in boyfriend. Now, 5 years later, she's a special events planner for museums. She's married to a man she mindfully chose. She loves her new career, she loves her new family, and she sent me a card that said, "Now the emergency contact blanks don't seem big enough."
So what's wonderful about that critical period in your 20s is that you're poised for transformation and change. It's an incredibly easy time to change yourself, and especially for 20-somethings who aren't happy with how their lives have gone, this is really life's greatest do-over.
Psychologist Meg Jay, she wrote a book called The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter. Her full TED Talk is worth checking out, and if you're in your 20s, my apologies in advance for every relative who will now email you the link to this talk. Anyway, as Meg Jay, I think, sort of suggests, being in your 20s can kind of suck. Because up to that point, your whole life has been mapped out. High school, then maybe college, and then you're 22 or 23, and you're out. The safety net's gone. And the world is like, go figure it out. Well, most millennials in their 20s had to do that right in the middle of the biggest economic collapse in 80 years.
I was actually in New York the day that that happened. I walked in front of Lehman Brothers, and there were all these cameras and these people walking out in suits, and the cameras were swarming them. And my dad and I walked by, and we were like, what is going on?
That's the jumping off point for Charlie Hone's story. He told it on the TEDx stage.
My entire life, I've done what everyone told me I should do. From kindergarten to my senior year of college, I had a high GPA. I volunteered, I played sports, I was in groups, extracurricular activities, student council. I did all that stuff. I was checking off the boxes in order to become a successful American. So by the time I graduated in 2008, after 12 weeks of applying for jobs to dozens of companies, maybe even 100, I had been turned down by every single one of them, with the exception of two. One was a staging company whose only job requirements were have a pulse and be a chain smoker. And the other company was a pyramid scheme. So thank you, careerbuilder.com. And my friends were all going through the same thing. It wasn't just me. And I remember coming across a buddy of mine, and they were so excited because everyone had been saying, you gotta take what you can get in this market. And they had just landed a sales rep position at Verizon Wireless. And they thought within a year, maybe they could make middle manager. And I was like, what? Did we really just spend the last 4 years? No, the last 17 years pursuing this stuff that other people told us to do. And this is what it's, where it's gonna take us? Verizon Wireless? Selling crappy cell phones? I hate Verizon. I didn't want that at all. And that's what brought me here. The bathroom floor, where I laid on the ground for an hour one night, just like pulling my hair out in frustration, like that advice that I took for my whole life, it was a lie, it was a scam. The stuff that my friends were telling me were
Dude, you gotta keep shotgun blasting your resume out to these websites, man. CareerBuilderMonster.com, that's where it's at. No, it's not. These sites are terrible. These sites are like city bars. They're where mediocrity thrives. Because there's only gonna be two hot offers in the bar. And the rest are gonna be wildly mediocre.
So you basically decided that you were going to figure something else out. And what, one day you just say, screw this, and you came up with a strategy.
Mm-hmm. I just decided I'm just going to do work that I want to do, and if I don't get paid for it, so be it.
And that is free work. And some of you might be sitting there thinking, oh, I know what free work is. It's an internship. That's nothing new, guy. An internship is actually very different from free work. An internship, you're applying for like it's a regular job. And then if you get that internship, you're gonna be given menial work from 9 to 5. And at the end, there are no guarantees. You might do this for 3 to 6 months and the door's gonna close. They'll tell you to hit the bricks. With free work, it's different. You can work with anyone in the world and you can reach out to them virtually. And there are no dead ends. If you do this correctly, if you work for a bunch of people, then something will pan out.
My strategy was to find people that I wanted to be like, who were doing things that I thought were really interesting or meaningful or cool. And then I approached them and I said, hey, I'm a huge fan of your work. I think that you could improve in these particular areas, and I would like to solve this problem for you.
For free?
Yeah.
Okay, so what'd you do?
The first guy I wrote to is a guy named Ramit Sethi. He writes a website called I Will Teach You to Be Rich.
Okay, so Charlie says to Ramit, looks like you could use some help with video editing. And so they start to work together.
So this was another thing I was doing simultaneously. So Seth Godin,
he's the author and marketing expert.
I was just basically helping him build out Squidoo.com.
And Charlie was doing all of this on his computer in his parents' basement for free.
And every now and then I would get temporary paid jobs.
So at some point, he starts doing free work for the author, Tim Ferriss.
And then he asked me if I wanted to help him write his next book, The 4-Hour Body. I said, absolutely.
This time for real money.
And it required me to move out to San Francisco to help him full time.
America is in a tough time. It is a tough market for us. But there's good news. And the good news is, as long as there are problems that need to be solved, there will always be work. And I'm here today to ask you guys to try free work, because I want you to chase after the things that interest you and make you happy.
Do you feel like that is a luxury your generation has, or it's a necessity?
You can call it either. It's just, I think that's just the way it is. And I think mostly it is a necessity. If you look at it like a luxury, it makes it sound like, oh, you know, all the other people suffered before you. Why shouldn't you have to suffer?
You need to stop acting like you have a set path in life. You don't. No one does. And so when I ask you to try this free work concept, I want you to ask yourself the same question I asked myself on the bathroom floor 3 years ago. What is the worst that could happen?
Okay, so at this point, you might be thinking, great, Charlie, worked out for you, but he actually got burned out, and one day, he quit. He just quit his job.
I took a few months off to kind of just figure out what I wanted to do next, and I had no idea. I ended up trying to found an app company with a friend of mine for a few months, and realized that wasn't what I wanted to do either. I mean, figuring out who I was and what I wanted to work on, you know, it gave me a lot of inner turmoil.
Wow. I mean, a lot of people were like, you made it, Charlie. Like, you got out of this. And inside you were like, I'm freaking out.
Yeah. There was a great Bob Dylan quote. When he made Like a Rolling Stone, he talked about how the music he was making before that he just didn't really like, but he had everyone telling him how great he was. And he said, it's very tiring hearing people tell you how much they dig you when you yourself don't dig you. And that's exactly how I felt.
You know what's crazy to me about being in your 20s now is that everybody was on Facebook, like, for as long as you can remember. And that's a highlight reel, right? Like, people aren't going to say, oh, today I got fired and I'm a loser and put that on Facebook. Like, they're going to say, oh, look at me hanging out with Ben Affleck in Hollywood. And, like, that's pressure, man.
Totally. We only want to show the good side to other people. But really, where you make the deepest connections is when you let your guard down and show some of the ugly side and the vulnerabilities and the insecurities. And that's the beautiful part, because we all have that.
It's Charlie Hone. He's 27 now with a new plan. He's writing a book on how to get out of college and stay out of your parents' basement. More millennials in a moment. I'm Guy Raz. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And today's show is all about the next greatest generation, millennials, and how they're changing almost everything we thought we knew. Like, who gets to be famous?
It's Friday, Friday. Gotta get down on Friday. Everybody's looking forward to the weekend.
Friday, Friday. Gotta get down on Friday. Friday.
You're a day early, my friend.
No, it's Thursday. But to me, it's Friday.
That's right. It's always Friday at YouTube.
So YouTube's got to be full of millennials.
Could you define what...
A millennial technically is somebody born between 1981 and 2000.
So then yes.
Right?
The answer is yes.
This is Kevin Alaka. He's 29, and he is the trends manager at YouTube. Did you... Okay, let me test you. Did you see Cookie Monster doing Me Want It?
Yeah, wonderful.
But me wait, me want it, but me wait.
We were very proud because our team here saw it when it only had like 20,000 hits, mm-hmm. which was kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
So it's Kevin's job to watch all of these videos.
I have the sort of privilege to spend a lot of my day trying to understand the things that are popular on YouTube.
Kevin is paid to figure out why things like that song about Friday, sung by an unknown teenager named Rebecca Black, why they become so huge. Here's the start of his TED Talk.
We all want to be stars, celebrities, singers, comedians. And when I was younger, that seemed so very, very hard to do. But now web video has made it so that any of us or any of the creative things that we do can become completely famous and a part of our world's culture. Any one of you could be famous on the internet by next Saturday. But there are over 48 hours of video uploaded to YouTube every minute. And of that, only a tiny percentage ever goes viral and gets tons of views and becomes a cultural moment. So how does it happen?
You know, when I first saw that Rebecca Black video, you know, I couldn't believe it. Like, I thought, my God, I mean, tens of millions of people have now watched it. And then I thought for a minute, well, it doesn't really matter what I think of it or whether I think the quality of it, you know, sucks. It's been put out there and people kind of responded to it.
I think actually it does matter. And that's actually the interesting thing here, right? The act of you thinking about it and wanting to have an opinion on it is what has made that thing so popular. And this is the confusing thing to people who haven't grown up with this stuff. Talk to a teenager, they will sort of completely understand why that's popular. And it's because they love to talk about and be a part of things. And so it didn't actually matter whether, you know, someone has declared it good or not, because it just became a part of the cultural conversation.
So it didn't matter that some people hated it. I mean, lots of people hated it.
I think that a lot of people liked to hate it is the thing, right? They liked to share the fact that they didn't like it. It becomes this fun inside joke.
I wonder also, like, that connection that this generation, you know, younger consumers have with pop stars and with the media they consume. It's so much more intimate, even though... tens, 20, 30 million people see something, it's almost like they're closer to it than screaming girls watching the Beatles play.
Yeah. I mean, it's because we participate in the popularity of those things, I think, right? That's actually the one of the defining things about the difference between what we had before and what we have now is this ability to have interactive fandom and interactive entertainment. And you just said to me a moment ago, you said, have you seen that video of Cookie Monster? we saw it when it only had X amount of views. You feel like you were a part of the early days of that video.
Right. I saw it when it had 11,000 views.
Yes, you feel like you were first on board with that, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's a really, it's a really, one of the really cool things about how this stuff works, because you didn't say, oh, I watched it with 11 million other people when it was broadcast on TV, right? Like, you didn't. You saw it at a certain point, and you were a part of the sort of flow of this thing.
Yeah. I tweeted it out before BuzzFeed.
There you go, see?
What's your favorite video of all time?
You know, I feel like sometimes I should have a really great answer. There's a thing you must go look up right now, and it's
going to change your life.
Yeah, but the truth of it is, I actually still really love the Double Rainbow. Bear Vasquez posted this video that he had shot outside his home in Yosemite National Park.
Whoa, that's a full rainbow.
He one day comes out and witnesses this.
Double rainbow, oh my God.
It's amazing, it's beautiful. He's profoundly moved by this sight.
Whoa, oh my God, oh my God. Oh my God, woo! It's so beautiful.
It starts for many people with a, I can't believe how this guy is reacting to this thing.
Oh my God, look at that.
But very quickly, and even in the course of the video, you yourself are sort of just sharing in his same emotion.
Double rainbow all the way across the sky.
You're having this weird channeled moment with him.
What does this mean?
Oh. In 2010, it was viewed 23 million times. But he didn't actually set out to make a viral video, Bear. He just wanted to share a rainbow, because that's what you do when your name is Yosemite Mountain Bear. And it's a communal thing, because you're not just watching it and then saying, okay, that's that. Like, you feel this impulse to be like, I can't believe I just saw that. You have to see this too. We have to talk about this thing together. And I want to watch you watching this thing, because I will get a lot of pleasure out of that, right? And so it all brings us to one big question.
What does this mean? Oh.
What does it mean? These are characteristics of a new kind of media and a new kind of culture where anyone has access and the audience defines the popularity. One of the biggest stars in the world right now, Justin Bieber, got his start on YouTube. No one has to green light your idea, and we all now feel some ownership in our own pop culture. And these are not characteristics of old media, and they're barely true of the media of today. But they will define the entertainment of the future. Thank you.
I wonder if that is going to be this generation's legacy, that they basically made it possible for people to not need permission to get on stage.
Yeah. And there's a question for me about, you know, how much the technology is shaping the generation, because a lot of this is about the ability to openly distribute things, right? So how much is the technology shaping that generation, and how much has the generation and its impulses and behaviors shaped the technology? I think for a site like YouTube that has all of these, you know, different elements to it, you know, that are sort of somewhat game-changing about culture and education and entertainment, we feel like it's very much shaped by the people who use it.
Kevin Alaka, he's the trends manager at YouTube. You can hear his full talk at ted.npr.org. What do people say about your generation?
The simple thing that I hear the most is just like, they're lazy and technology addicted. And yes, part of me is like, wait, this is how I'm spending my youth, like checking Twitter on my phone. But part of me is also like, you'd be doing it too if you were our age right now.
This is Tavi Gevinson. She's 17 now, but when she was 11?
If I went to school and I was dressed kind of strangely, it was either like I was acting out for attention or I'd like just didn't get it.
So she started her own community. It was a blog about fashion. She called it Style Rookie, and suddenly
there were enough people who saw that, like, I maybe had something to say beyond just being, like, young and goofy. So I was able to
sustain an audience for a little while.
An audience of 50,000 readers a day. Anna Wintour of Vogue invited her to the front row of Fashion Week. Lady Gaga called her the future of journalism. And this was all while Tavi was in middle school. So, in high school?
My name's Tavi Gevinson.
Tavi gave a TED Talk.
The title of my talk is Still Figuring It Out. And the
part of figuring it all out for Tavi was whether she wanted to be this famous fashion blogger, because when she started high school, she had other things, a lot of things on her mind.
I was trying to reconcile all of these differences that you're told you can't be when you're growing up as a girl. You can't be smart and pretty. You can't be a feminist who's also interested in fashion. You can't care about clothes if it's not for the sake of what other people, usually men, will think of you. So I think the question of what makes a strong female character often goes misinterpreted. And instead, we get these two-dimensional superwomen who maybe have one quality that's played up a lot, like she plays her sexuality up a lot and it's seen as power, but they're not strong characters who happen to be female. They're completely flat and they're basically cardboard characters. The problem with this is that then people expect women to be that easy to understand, and women are mad at themselves for not being that simple, when in actuality, women are multifaceted, not because women are crazy, but because people are crazy and women happen to be people. So the flaws are the key. I'm not the first person to say this. What makes a strong female character is a character who has weaknesses, who is maybe not immediately likable, but eventually relatable. So I was trying to figure all that out, and I felt a little confused, and I said so on my blog, and I said that I wanted to start a website for teenage girls that was not this kind of one-dimensional, strong character empowerment thing. I got about 3,000 emails. My editorial director and I went through them and put together a staff of people, and we launched last September.
That was September 2011, and it was even bigger than her first website. In its first week, 1 million page views. She calls it Rookie. Why do you call it Rookie?
It turned out to be, like, the only word for a young girl that didn't have some weird kind of, like, double meaning. Like, blossom. Everything was too precious and flowery.
And it's like, okay, you're a rookie. You're just starting out. You're trying to, like, figure it out kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's not, like, positive or negative. It's just what it is. You're just in the beginning. And I just felt like teenage girls are the subject of so much in the media and in pop culture, but they so rarely have a platform to speak for themselves. And I thought, you know, starting Rookie would be an easy way to do that without having to deal with the complications of, like, working with a publisher to publish an actual magazine.
Why do you think so many girls trust you, trust your site?
We have a really amazing staff of contributors who offer up less than flattering pieces of themselves. And I feel like the basis of a lot of people relating to each other through writing or art of any kind is just when you expose your own weaknesses and vulnerabilities. So I think we have a lot of really talented staffers who do that in their writing or in their photography or illustration. I think girls feel like it's for them, and it is.
And the thing is, I guess the advantage you have over, you know, girls from 20 years ago is that you can all connect pretty easily.
I think that no matter what, if you don't fit in somewhere, you'll fit in somewhere else, and it's easier to find that online. So I think that just being able to have more access to whatever tools help get you through high school, because really, no one, you can never, like, solve high school. It never just, like, becomes okay all the time. All you can really do is, like, develop tools for dealing with it, and I think that can be, like, key. And of course, having access to communities where you can directly talk to other people instead of, like, reading a mainstream magazine and wondering what's wrong with you because you don't relate.
And this is an excerpt from my first editor's letter where I say that, Rookie, we don't have all the answers. We're still figuring it out too. But the point is not to give girls the answers, but hopefully inspire them to understand that they can ask their own questions, find their own answers, all of that. And Rookie, I think we've been trying to make it a nice place for all of that to be figured out. So I'm not saying, like, be like us and we're perfect role models, because we're not, but we just want to help represent girls in a way that shows those different dimensions. I mean, we have articles called On Taking Yourself Seriously, How to Not Care What People Think of You, but we also have articles like How to Look Like You Weren't Just Crying in Less Than 5 Minutes. So, what I want you to take away from my talk, the lesson of all of this, is to just be Stevie Nicks. Like, that's all you have to do. Because my favorite thing about her, other than like everything, is that she is has always been unapologetically present on stage, and unapologetic about her flaws and about reconciling all of her contradictory feelings. And she makes you listen to them and think about them. And yeah, so please be Stevie Nicks. Thank you.
I mean, when you gave that talk, you were describing trying to figure it out, but I wonder if that process ever really ends, right? Do you get to a point in life when you're like, I figured it out?
You know, we were just talking about this, and all of the adult writers were saying, like, oh yeah, when I was in my 20s, I thought I would get to a point where I would just, like, be fine. And, you know, I've had that idea in my head too, but of course it's like the minute you have a handle on things, there's a whole world around you that is also changing while you are, so things are different, you have to readjust, and you have to figure out new things, so one thing we talk about a lot is just, like, giving yourself permission to change and try new things and, you know, eventually find yourself and you see what sticks. And, I mean, that scared me for a while, but I've tried to learn to see that as really kind of freeing and exciting.
Do you ever think of yourself as like, part of a generation?
I think I do, because I just feel so constantly aware of how different life is now than how it was. Like, entirely because of technology, and because I have this feeling that I'm able to kind of pick from all pop culture of the past, like a kind of buffet. And I'm aware, because people constantly tell me that this isn't something you could always do. You know, like, a lot of people tell me, like, oh, it makes me sad because when I was your age, I had to, like, go to a record store and discover that band, and it was so special, and I knew nothing about them, and it was so mysterious. And I'm like, I'm kind of glad that I can find out as much about them as I want. I guess every generation probably feels like, oh, life is so different now than it was back then, but, like, this feels drastic. Just like the white winged dove sings a song that sounds like she's singing.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Tavi Gevinson, she's the founder of Rookie Mag and a card-carrying member of the Next Greatest Generation. Her awesome talk can be found at TED.com. Fast internet, stay connected in a jet. Wi-Fi podcast, blasting out of SMS. Google is my professor, Wikipedia checker. Checking my account, logging in and logging out. Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com, and you can download and subscribe to this program through iTunes or the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Eva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.